Namaste. It's a joy to be in this energy field with such beautiful beings of purity and devotion to truth and to goodness and to the real. And so I want to welcome those who are here recently and to wish you blessings on this inner journey as well as outer journey into the depths of your being and into the unique world of ashram consciousness and way of life, and to offer blessings for liberation from whatever bondages might be felt in the heart or the mind or the body. So that's my first point on the agenda. And the second is to greet all the members of the Sangha and to offer blessings for Jivan Mukti, because now is the moment that our destinies are being determined by the quality of our choice of the meaning of our experience in every moment. So I thought that I'm going to ask those who are just recent arrivals or returnees to offer some words, if you wish. But I wanted to first establish a core aspect of ashram life. And I think that if we were speaking in a more academic or anthropological context, we would say that there are certain rituals that are reiterated in an ashram situation. And probably the most common of those is the offering of the invocatory mantra, Namaste, right? We say Namaste at the beginning, at the end, often in the middle, and in many different moments of greeting, whether of individuals or groups, and it has a very unique and important significance, and if that significance is not understood, then I would say 90% of ashram life will not be understood. So Who knows what the word namaste means? Karuna.
I greet the divine in you, or it's a...
It's not actually greet, okay? Some say salute, but the actual meaning is I bow to you. Namaste, te means to you. I bow to you. And interestingly, it's a singular you, not a plural you. It's not, oh, I bow to you all, you know, it's not that. It's a singularity in every case. And why is that? Because namaste cannot be properly spoken if you are in a state of consciousness that is dualistic, that is divided into subject and object. We are not here to bow to each other. We are here only to bow to God. But because our practice is based on the realization that God is all that is real, then everyone that you are bowing to is a manifestation of the one self, which is you. And so we are bowing to Shiva, or use any other name you wish, but that's the oldest name of that supreme power that has created, sustains, destroys all worlds, conceals his true nature, and reveals it. Those are the five great acts of Shiva. And in this offering of namaste, we are invoking the revelation. By bowing to Shiva, we are asking for Shiva's presence to be revealed as you. And so we are bowing not just to Shiva, but we are bowing to the act of bowing. Because what does it mean to bow, really? It's a surrender. It's a kind of sacrifice of autonomy. It is a humbling of the self. But more than that, if we really go into the anatomy of non-dual bhakti, which is what this practice is, then we would have to say that the pronunciation of the mantra namaste is the equivalent in Christian terms of a sacrament. It's the enunciation of the liturgy. And liturgy is a speech act. But it's a particular kind of speech act. It's a performative act. So when we talk about sacrament, which is both sacred mind, sacramente, right, and the sacrifice of mind, what we are saying is that the sacrifice that is being made is of the mind of duality to the realization of the infinite mind of non-duality. It is a complete dropping away of dualistic thought. And in the act of bowing, the wisdom schools, especially the Kashmir wisdom schools, which emphasized the use of this invocation as a greeting, the bowing has a number of different strata to it. First, the waking state ego bows to the dream state where the soul has its abode. The ego bows to the soul. The waking bows to the dream. And the dream bows to deep sleep, because what is deep sleep? It is the absence of ego, the absence of soul, the absence of mind. And the deep sleep state bows to the Turiya state, bows to what occurs, what is revealed if you are awake in deep sleep. What is revealed is the presence of the Shiva Prakash, the light of God within your consciousness. It shines there. And this is why if we are in sleep deficit, we lose our life energy, because you need to sleep to connect to the source of the energy of life. Our prana is restored in deep sleep, not in dream. That often will be agitated and anxious and will be an expenditure of life energy. If there are unresolved conflicts within the ego that remain, if one is trying to sleep without having resolved them, then the dreams will reveal the internal landscape of conflict and multiplicity. But if you have surrendered to Shiva Prakash, then that light of non-duality will shine through the dream and the waking state, so that the current of Shakti remains constant in all the avastas, all the different phases of consciousness. But the Turiya state must also then bow to Turiyatita. The Prakasha must bow to the Vimarsha, because the light of God itself is an emanation of God's intelligence, God's freedom, God's presence. The light is not the source, it is the emanation, just like the light of the sun emanates from the sun. But the sun itself, that is what we are bowing to, the central sun of all universes, the source of light, the source of intelligence, the source of love, the source of willpower. And so it is that sacrifice and surrender and bowing of every level of consciousness to the absolute source that brings us home, that brings us to the supreme real. And so in every moment of uttering the word namaste, the utterance should achieve its own realization of what it means. That's the meaning of a sacrament, where the performative act creates what the act is signifying, what the words are signifying. And that is what it makes it truly sacred. And so the word must be spoken in that state of non-dual surrender and unity with the supreme power of being, of consciousness, of presence, that is also absence, emptiness, non-being, the void, the complete freedom from any definition, any qualities that identify, any marks of a limited manifestation. It is the unlimited and the unconditional. And so that utterance reminds us and brings us back to the truth of Shiva consciousness. And because we utter it often during the day, we are often reminded and given the opportunity to return to that supreme reality if we have fallen from that unified state of presence. And if you say it with a total sincerity, an authentic sincerity of truly bowing to Shiva, the consciousness will enter a space transcendent of the world. that space of the luminous, infinite expanse of timeless awareness of the presence of the inconceivable source of our being. And so Satyoga is not a philosophy, it's not a doctrine, it's not a theory, a belief system, a dogma. It's a practice. And that practice is brought into a nutshell in that one word of namaste. It's all contained in that mantra. And because each utterance is a bowing to Shiva in all that is manifest, it creates a unified field of total coherence in which there are no separations or conflicts. All of that is overcome in the bowing to Shiva, in which all is recognized as perfect. And then we abide as undivided elements of that indivisible wholeness in its perfection, that because of its perfection has neither desire nor fear nor any agitation, but abides in the stillness of fulfillment. And so this one practice brings you to Jivanmukti. Nothing else is required. Namaste.
Namaste.
So, I would like to ask those who have recently arrived, if you would like to say anything, ask anything, sing anything, scream anything, whatever, but if you would like to offer any information or ask any questions, this is an opportunity. And I would like to meet each of you, so if you would speak, I think that would enable us to connect more deeply. And that includes Deb and our returning Nicolette as well.
My name is Petra.
Petra.
Yes.
Welcome. The Rock.
Yes. Turned out, I didn't know when I was younger, but it turned out to my friends, and so I'm there for them. So it's
Vibration is doing a job.
Wonderful.
Yeah, we and my husband Flo, so we feel very blessed to be here. We did a long trip, and and we are actually overwhelmed by the kindness, the love, the beauty of the ashram and obviously the community. So wanted to say thank you that we feel very welcome here and we feel very blessed to have the opportunity to be here.
Thank you very much for that and welcome to you and blessings.
And namaste, I'm Flo.
Flo, are you in a flow state? You're the opposite of the rock.
Well, it's a journey.
Very complimentary.
It's a journey. But it's beautiful to have a rock to hold on to. For sure. Yeah, I'm super grateful to be here. We're talking about questions. Well, I'm not going to start with questions. There are too many. But yeah, really wonderful to be here. Thank you very much. Namaste.
Okay. Welcome to you, Flo.
Thank you. Namaste. Namaste. Yeah, it's really beautiful to be back in this space. Gratitude has been coming up to me a lot. Mm. The mind wants to get caught in doing mode. And every morning I wake up and I look outside my balcony and I say how beautiful and how grateful that I'm immersed in this space. But truly, I think what made me cry the other morning is I was looking out at the nature and I was appreciating how just so beautiful it was, and realized that the reason that I'm so attracted and drawn to that beauty is because it actually lies in my heart. And so it was just a really, yeah, looking at nature and seeing that reflected into the nature of who I am, and all of the lies of the ego mind that are like there constantly throughout the day, or yeah, not real. So yeah, it's okay. Been honored to be here.
May you be free of that ego mind soon, so that the mind of the absolute self becomes your true nature in a real present way, that you have access to download the intelligence of God in every moment. And no more duality or deception of the mind with all of its preconceptions, projections, and internal figures of conflict, so that there is just pure peace.
Namaste.
You were hiding back there.
Yes. I'm Natalie, and it's an honor to be here. And, just feel really welcome, and just everyone's so nice. There's so much beauty everywhere, and it's just everything's filled with love. It's really kind of overwhelming. It's very nice.
Okay. Thank you, and welcome. Blessings.
I too feel just profound gratitude for being here. The past 2 months have felt to me as though I've been through a kind of vortex of requirements and regulations and decisions and relinquishments in order to get here. And throughout that time, I have constantly held the image of sitting in this room with all of you and longing to do that again. So I also just, I feel so profoundly welcomed, and that means everything to me. So thank you to all of you for that. And thank you to Shiva for making it possible for me to be here. Namaste to all.
And you're very welcome. It's a joy to see you again, Deb. And I'm glad you had the perseverance to jump through all those hoops and overcome the obstacles. And that's a very good sign. And how is your beloved Macaulay settling in?
Oh, you're so sweet. She too is thrilled to be here. She's finding her way, but now she can't wait to go outside, particularly when it's dark or dusk.
And she'll have many friends in the neighborhood.
And she'll be doing her seva before long.
Yes.
Thank you for allowing her to come.
You're welcome. Okay. So an ashram is a community dedicated to liberation. The liberation of consciousness from all delusions and all bondages. It's a place for those who want to live in freedom from the unreal, from subjection to the unreal. Subjection means slavery. But it's very interesting that the word that's most common for consciousness is subjectivity. And subjectivity comes from that same word, subjection, which is a kind of enslavement, or at least a subordination. If you're a subject of the king or the queen, if you're in one of those countries that still has such, who don't any longer have divine rights for those positions, but nonetheless they're there at least as a formality. But the subject must pledge their allegiance. But freedom is a kind of anarchy, because you don't bow to anyone but the Supreme Self as yourself, not as another. And so you're claiming that divine right of freedom. So we could say that there are two kinds of consciousness. The subject, who has become subjected to the other, to powers outside of itself. And the other kind of consciousness that is not any longer a subject, but a soul. A soul dedicated to the realization of their true nature as freedom itself. So the first kind of subjectivity is ego consciousness. And the ego is formed when the body is in infancy. In fact, it begins even when the fetus is still in the uterus of the mother, because her projections and those of the father will affect the ego identity of that being even before birth. And so the ego is subject to the power of the other. And hopefully that power is benign, that the parents have unconditional love and adoration for their child, but that is not always the case at the end of Kali Yuga. And even if it seems to be the case when one's a baby, but when once one learns to speak and can talk back to the parents, then the love tends to turn to a kind of disciplinarian conditionality. And that sense of having the mother as one's slave, which is the original delusion, then becomes the terror of being enslaved. But because the ego desires power, it wants the power that it sees or projects into the other, it internalizes the other and makes them into a superego, so that you become internally subjected to a mental object in your own mind that you internalized in order to feel powerful, but forever after you will be under its power. And the superego can cause you at any moment to feel guilt, shame, a horror, dread, a feeling of wrongness, all kinds of emotional agitations that you are subject to. And you cannot release, because the ego has made a kind of pact with that superego that it will keep it there in order to be able to sometimes identify with it and feel like it's the parent, it's the boss. And then at other times it will be afraid of or angry at an other that it projects as its superego now outside of itself. And because the superego can create such agitation, the ego wants to constantly project either the superego or the child victim of the superego onto the other in order to retain power. Right? Because the will to power paradoxically takes away your power, makes you a slave, but is the addiction of the ego. It will not give up its desire for power. And that desire is what causes it to lose its power. And to lose its capacity for coherence. Why? Because once the superego comes in, it brings with it, or even is a manifest part of, what is an agency of censorship, self-censorship. And as an infant, it acts to again give you the power to tune out unpleasant stimuli. So you often see babies will just go to sleep if there's an unpleasant situation, or they will run behind the mother's skirt, or they will do something, but they will censor the information that's coming in or the stimulus that they can't handle. But once the censoring agency is internalized, it autonomously then controls the amount of information your conscious mind can receive from the environment, how much it can retain, how much it can process, how much will be forgotten, how much will be distorted, misunderstood, turned into a manifestation of its preconceived needs for conflict or for seduction or for intimidation, whatever is the algorithm that has been implanted in the ego by the superego's injunction as to who you should be and how you should be. And so a script, an internal script, an internal developmental pattern is installed that creates a ceiling on how high your consciousness can grow to levels beyond that original programming. And so at a certain moment, the ego moves from being the structuring element that allows you to make sense of the world and feel in control of it to a kind of enslavement to something that prevents you from realizing your full potentiality. And it's only then when you realize that your ego is your enemy, not your friend, and not you, even though its thoughts are impersonating you, because it uses the I thought, and then if you hear the I thought in your mind, you assume that you are thinking rather than the ego or superego thinking you into a certain mode of reactivity. And so that confusion that is also censored creates the avidya, the ignorance, the delusion that's the cause of all suffering. And the only way out of that is to delete the entire program of the ego, including the censor and the superego. If they are not removed, then they act as an internalized God figure, but a false God, obviously, that will prohibit the growth to a level of real freedom and real access to the infinite non-local nature of your consciousness. It will keep you identified with your body form and with the signifiers of identity that were installed along with the ego. And the problem is that the ego takes that as its comfort zone, even if it's very uncomfortable. It feels like home. I know how to deal with this. Whereas the fear of the unknown, the fear of freedom itself, the fear of the infinite, keeps most beings who are in the ego from even daring to consider going beyond that, because you won't know who you are, and you'll have to deal with that not knowing until that emptiness of all desire to know. Because if you know, it's because you learned it from outside. All desire to know from outside turns into the realization of your beingness that is beyond what can be known by language, by imagery, by behavior, by any of the ways that you have identified and oriented yourself in the phenomenal plane. And so it requires cultivating a taste for that absolute freedom of intelligence that transcends all frames of reference. We want to have a frame of reference within the ego, because then I have certainty. I know I'm right about this. And one can have opinions, and opinions give you a sense of power, even though your opinions are no doubt wrong. And the emotions they create are just sentimentality that supports the ego's mode of suffering. Because the enjoyment of the ego is also the cause of its suffering. And the ego is lost in the register of consciousness that we refer to, thanks to Lacan and psychoanalytic theory, as the imaginary. It's a good name for it, the imaginary. It has to do with images, and it has to do with a superficial belief system in which you think you understand what others are saying to you, and you think you understand what you are saying and thinking, even though you actually don't know what words really mean. You assume that they mean a certain thing because they have certain associations in the past. But other people have different associations, and they can use the same word with an entirely different meaning. And so the signifier, the word, the sound, slides over the signified. It can mean different things, and you don't know what it means. These days, if you hear people talking about democracy, that signifier means totalitarian enslavement, right? It doesn't mean what it once meant. And so all of the language that we have is being subversively reset by the big other via the media and via all of the ways that people are indoctrinated into conventional forms of communication, which are miscommunication, which again and reinforce the enslavement of your subjectivity, not any longer to a family system, but to a larger social system. And that enslavement is often not recognized for the limitations on the horizons of possibility that it creates. And that it creates barriers to reaching God consciousness and your infinite nature beyond life and death. And so the ego remains with this electric fence of fear of death, fear of the unknown, fear of abandonment by the other, fear, therefore, the need to be dependent or codependent on others, and the projection that others have what you lack as an ego, just as the baby lacked certain motor skills that the parents had, and that sense of lack creates a constant agitation of desire within the ego that produces a sense of not being where it should be or what it should be, and always thinking it has to strive to be more, to be better, to be worthy, to be whatever in its own mind due to the superego attacks upon its true nature as a perfect manifestation of the ground, the foundation of all that is. And because of being identified with the body that is under a command system of language, which is how you were originally controlled, by being given a name so you could be called, so you could be disciplined, that structure of discipline operates by maintaining a constant regime of mental chatter that keeps you from discovering the true nature of your consciousness that is free of such conditioning. And so this command and control system that has been installed is the real obstacle to your happiness. But the ego will hide that from you and cause a projection that, no, you're unhappy because the food didn't taste the way you wanted it, or the temperature is this way, or these people are like this when they should be like that, or whatever. But the blame goes out to the environment and never gets targeted at the real cause of one's suffering. And so there is never a strong dedication to internalizing one's power of freedom through the purification of the consciousness by eliminating ego and superego and censor and flushing out the subconscious fantasies that have controlled the flow of desire and of fear, and that create a constant context of limitation and lack. And so the practice of Sat Yoga is to overcome all that and return to the unborn, uncreated nature of absolute consciousness that knows itself in silence and stillness. And within that stillness, whatever needs to be known, whatever needs to be done, whatever needs to be felt at any given moment will be accessed, will flow. And this is the concept of the Tao. If you are attuned to the source of your being, you will always be the master of the present moment, in which your response will be spontaneous, not thought out, not figured out, not calculated, but a response that is immediate and accurate because it is based in non-duality, not in projection or fantasy, but in the real. And so it's an entirely different mode of functioning of consciousness itself, that such a quantum leap from ego that it can't even be imagined. It's not in our imaginary. And the easiest way to get there is via the symbolic register of consciousness. And you get there through negating the imaginary. This is the meaning of the neti neti of yogic practice. I am not this, I am not that. I am not the body, I am not the mind, I am not the ego, I am not any mental object, etc. And once you eliminate everything, what is left? An inconceivable presence. And then the power of that presence becomes manifest so long as the mind retains the emptiness, is not subject to the noise of the ego creating incoherence. That's when one will have a unified consciousness in which the willpower will no longer be divided or conflicted, and there will be no more delusions, and what is accomplished will have that spark of genius and greatness that comes from the real self. And that's how a renaissance is brought into being, how new worlds come into being when old worlds are ready to die. And that is how continuity of consciousness from one world to another is attained. And that's what is known as immortality. And so what we are here to do is the churning of the ocean of consciousness through the recognition of these forces that are in dualistic conflict and allowing those conflicts to flush out everything that is underneath them, everything that is part of the subconscious ocean, letting it all go. And out of that will come many jewels of the real as well as the unreal that needs to be completely eliminated. And it will create that nectar of immortality. But that means that one must contain everything that arises without judgment, without intention, and let it arise and become what it is aiming at. So the problem with desire, which we're going to go into much more deeply in the retreat, is that it is hooked to an imaginary object. And every ego discovers that the object they thought they desired, as soon as they get it, they realize, oh, that wasn't it. That what is really desired is the freedom of the self, the glory of the self that was projected on that object. And so it's the reclaiming of all projections that brings you to the real goal of life, which is the fulfillment of the realization that the love you're looking for is what you are. And that love is the real power, and it's the real light, and it is that energy that is in constant attunement to the manifest as well as the unmanifest, nirvana and samsara, the relative and the absolute planes are unified by that love, the consummation of that love, of Shiva and Shakti, of pragya and karuna, of jnana and kriya. At every different level, there's a unification of a duality. And when all of those dualities have been unified, then the path of liberation is open. And so the practice is that letting go of the choice of one polarity or another. No, don't choose either one. It's not about right or wrong, yes or no. The eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was the problem. It's not the solution. The solution is the tree of life, the non-duality of presence without differentiation, without judgment. And this brings the wholeness, the fulfillment of the attainment of the source of love, which is the source of life and the source of intelligence and the source of the power of creativity at every level. So that's Sat Yoga in brief. And if you understand that, then you don't even need to do anything else or read anything or do anything. It's a practice of being in that state. And once that practice becomes your second nature, then there's no one left to practice, because the practice is realization that the ego is not what you are. You are the one self that you are bowing to, and that self is already liberated. So there's no one to do anything and nothing to reach, because there's no bondage to escape from. All of that was the illusion. Once the illusion has been dissipated, you realize you were always free. You didn't even need to come to the ashram. But you created the ashram as a point of pilgrimage in order to give yourself the opportunity to do what otherwise you might not have done. You created the sacred space for your own liberation. And I appreciate that all of you have come here for that reason. And this is the time to achieve that goal of total freedom. So I hope everyone will claim that power and that right and achieve that ultimate destination of our consciousness here and now, so that we can serve to uplift all beings to oneness. So for the last time this evening, namaste. Okay. If there are any final questions, we have a couple of minutes. Someone can go to the mic and ask it. Are there any questions about any of this, or any comments anyone would like to make? The floor is open before we adjourn. If you do, just go to the mic and speak. Okay, going once, going twice. Ah, there is one. Okay.
Thank you, Shunya. Question arose when you were speaking about the superego. I was curious about the demiurge. I was just curious, at the individual level, would that apply to the superego or maybe the sensor? I'm not sure.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it's a fractal of the demiurgos, which is the mind of the, the collective consciousness in its entropic downward trajectory through the ages that brings us to a Kali Yuga. And gives hegemony to the asuric polarity of consciousness, not to the devic side. And so, yes, you could say that that's the force of entropy in consciousness that brings us to this point. But because there is a higher orgos than the demiurgos, we also have the power to lift ourselves out of the darkness into the light through self-realization. And we can overcome what is only apparently a superior power. Okay? Thank you. In the same way that the superego is not a superior power, but once you believe that it is, and that it has the power to shame you or to make you feel guilty or whatever, then you have given it that power to subject you to its decisions. Okay. Anyone else? Okay. We'll leave it there for this evening. Since we did our last namaste, I'm